my name is Benjamin Obidiah Iqbal Zephaniah, but everybody knows me as Benjamin Zephaniah. And I'm a poet, and sometimes I write novels and sometimes I write plays, but I'm here because I wrote a novel and Lem turned it into a play.
My name's Lem Sisse. I'm a poet, and I've written a few plays over the years.
What was it initially that drew you to Refugee Boy?
Refugee Boy is about a boy called Alem. My name's Lem, even though it's not got anything to do with Alem, but my parents are both from Ethiopia and Eritrea, and Alem is from Ethiopia and Eritrea. Benjamin Zephaniah is a poet and older brother. Much older, by the way. I don't think anybody else could have written Refugee Boy, and I think that I'm the perfect person to adapt it because of my experience as a person. That doesn't necessarily mean that I can write it really well, if I'm really honest with you, but I write it as best as I can. Sorry, that sounds really bad, actually. That sounds like I'm putting it down. What I mean is that I really, really wanted to do this, and I pleaded with Benjamin, basically locked him in a room for some time, took all of his gigs, and then as he saw his gigs going down and the fact that I was doing them...
And I'm becoming poor and
exactly. He said, okay, so I did it.
Excellent. Could you tell me then, how did you feel being approached about this as an author, somebody else kind of... I don't want to say tampering with you, but maybe putting a different spin on it.
Well, I think it's really good when a fresh pair of eyes and a fresh mind comes to something that someone else has written anyway. I really like when somebody else has a take on it, as long as they respect it. When I first spoke to Lem about it, he was just... so passionate about it. It was just so close to his own story. Lots of differences, but we all have differences, but there's some similarities, the Eritrean, Ethiopian.
Just that alone.
Yeah, just that, but also, you know, finding your feet in England and, you know, wondering what's happening back home. And I also think that the problem with me, I think one of the problems, probably a major problem if I was going to do it, I'd be too precious about it. And I'd be looking at, you know, what happens in chapter one, what happens in chapter two, and what happens in chapter three. And Lem just came with a completely different approach. So the heart of the story is the same. But to tell it on stage, it has to be different. And that's what he's done. It really is about it's about a subject we both feel passionate about. To be honest, you could approach it in many different ways. You know, Lem's approach it in one way, but what he hasn't done, he hasn't looked and said, well, you know, what did Benjamin do in chapter one? Well, I've got to do that. What did he do in chapter two? I've got to do that. You know, he's kind of retold it in a way that, first of all, it's suitable for what it's supposed to do, which is be a play that kind of educates and goes around and kids can identify with. And second of all, it remembers that there's a young human boy at the heart of it. That could almost be anybody. So Lem wrote it, but it could be an Irish refugee. It could be a Bosnian refugee. It could be a Kurdish refugee.
So that leads me on to my next question then, which is, you know, the book was written in, I think it was, is it 2001, 2000, that kind of time? I mean, to what extent do you think that the issues are kind of still pressing that are, kind of raised in Refugee Boy?
Should we get a newspaper now? Really?
Well, the thing is, we were asked this question before, and I thought about it since then, and not much has changed. I can't really think of any really big change in the way that refugees are viewed, the way that they are policed, the way that they are. I mean, I think there's, from the time that I wrote that, I think there's actually more. I'm looking for the word. I'm trying to get the politically right word. Asylum seekers or failed refugees locked up in places now, which are basically prisons. Yeah. They haven't committed any crime. A lot of them have been running from crime, being committed to them, and they're in prisons. So, in real terms, not much has changed.
So what do you think needs to be done then in terms of those refugees and people you say who are in essentially prisons?
Well, listen, I mean, there's an organisation called the Refugee Council, and some other experts in this area can answer this question much better than me. Mm. Anything I tell you will be stuff I learned from them, you know, about... we've got lots of empty houses, finding houses for them. We've got lots of organisations that can help them. We should be able to treat them with compassion and stuff like that. But, I mean, look at one of the biggest waves of refugees that have just come in now. Kurdish, Afghani, Iraqi. And this is not Ethiopian and Eritrean black people fighting each other. This is the British government went over there and created these refugees and then complained about them coming here. You know, and there's people like me who were at anti-war who said at the time, you're going to create a lot of disabled people, as well as a lot of dead people, of course, a lot of disabled people, and you're going to create a lot of refugees. So one of the things we can do if we want to stop creating so many refugees is stop interfering in people's business. And if there are refugees that we have nothing to do with, then we should be compassionate towards them.
But you see, and at the same time, no, not at the same time, just to agree with you, that interfering now in other people's business has become what is modern warfare.
Yes, yes.
You know, yeah. It's become the modern parlance of our relationship with the world. Is to interfere. And as Benjamin said, there is a direct tidal effect. If you send out bombs, you will then receive the refugees, and that's what's happening.
So what can people then, like poets and writers, do to kind of highlight these issues?
Yeah, they could write a book, some of them, you know. I mean, you know, if you look at what's happened with Refugee Boy, it's gone out across the world, translated into other languages, and is now being used to enlighten people to what is happening in their countries. You can say this better than me, Benjamin.
It's interesting because writing a novel, unlike writing a poem, you can write a poem sometimes very quickly and then just carry on going playing football. But writing a novel, you lock yourself away for a long time and
meditation.
You really get down to it. And you never know how it's going to be received. And then you put it out there. And it's just really moving and powerful and humbling, the effect it has on people. I mean, people come up to you in tears and they say... I've had people say, that book tells the story of me. I've had people say, I didn't give a damn about refugees until I read that book. From completely different spectrums. I've had one school who said that they were basically resisting it. You know, they didn't have a refugee problem in their school, their white school out in Devon or somewhere. And a pupil brought it in and said, look, we have to read this book. You know, we can't just keep saying that we don't have the problem because we don't have any ethnic people in here or we don't have any refugees in here. And in that school, they turned it into what they call a class reader. So, you know, it's just an idea that I had because of some experiences I had. But then to see the way it kind of ripples out is quite humbling. But we can do lots of things. I mean, first of all, the obvious one is that if you've got some time on your hand and stuff like that, you can go and volunteer in refugee organisations. Mm. There's a lot of... Britain now, for the first time since the war, has a growing... is a growing amount of what they call in America soup kitchens, you know, places where people go because they've got no food. And a lot of those people are refugees, not all refugees, obviously, just some of them are just people who just fell along the wayside. But you know, you can go and do things like that. There's one thing about people that are suffering in any way, is that they really appreciate somebody when they genuinely want to help them. So even if you go to them and you can say, if you go to in front of a refugee, I've got no power, I don't know any politicians, I can't write a book, I'm not a poet, I'm not a blogger. Do you want a sandwich? You know, some basic stuff like that. They'll tell you that, you know, that really helps them and gives them strength.
Because the action of giving them the sandwich is as more important almost than the sandwich itself. The act of saying, do you need something?
Yes.
And often people don't do that. They separate and they look across at the refugee, at the alien, at the this, at the other. It's that connection, which I think is what we're always
Christian. Missing. It's like the Christian thing of, you know, breaking bread with your brethren kind of thing. Mm. It's not because you're hungry. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that you're connecting with them.
Breaking bread, that's beautiful.
So, you know, and then there's other things you can do. If you're more connected, of course, you can talk to your local MPs and all that kind of stuff. You know, we can all do something. And if there's not much we can do physically, because what? You know, we've got 6 kids, we've got a job, and we've got this, and we've got to do that. You just got to be aware. And the next time you see somebody talk about refugees on television, don't just think of them as statistics.
So what can we expect then from the play Refugee Boy for anyone who's coming to see it or thinking about coming to see it, more importantly?
Well, what you can expect, I think, is a damn good story, first and foremost. You know, that's what...
I'm just reminding you why I write the book.
Carry on. It's a damn good story, you know.
I write the book.
Let's go for it. But what Benjamin said before was that you know, you see the statistics of refugees. You know, 1,000 have come here. 5. You hear numbers, don't you? You know. Years ago they talked about being swamped and blah, because numbers mean swamp, mean etc, etc, etc. And what Benjamin's done is put a magnifying glass on this mass that we're told is just a mass, on one single story inside of that statistic. See, I've started doing that now, by the way. You see that? Did you see that? I never used to do that, did I? And what he's focused in on one single story of that statistic that really represents all stories within that environment, and of this boy who's right at the heart of the subject of immigration. And it's a heartfelt human story which translates, good word, to anybody that experiences it in book form or in the play form. So it's a damn good story. And actually, if you think of the great stories, I'm trying to think now of you know, those Arabian stories, 100 Nights from when I was a kid, right. and Aladdin, and the Bible, and the Quran, you know, all those stories are about migration, about a people going from one place to another place. When you, as a child, become an adult, you migrate from childhood into adulthood. When I was a kid in Lancashire, the only black in the village, as you may know, but in Lancashire, the town around the corner was another world, you know, and you migrated as you grew older to that town, and it really was. You must remember that from when you were a kid, like, you don't go further than Handsworth Wood or wherever it was. Yeah. You know, we are constantly in a state of migration. It's natural. It's what birds do. It's what the wind does. It's what tides do. It's what the earth does. And so, to be anti-immigration is to be anti-natural, like feeding cows to cows. Quite topical. Feeding cows to cows. It's natural that there is often conflict, because, for me, borders are physical borders that are ruled by bureaucracy are unnatural. We have always moved as a people. Except for every country I go to, there's the foreigners, or the immigrants, or the blah, blah. There's an unease about it. That unease is because it is unnatural.
If you put up borders, by definition, you're going to need them protected. the best way...
You're saying let's go to war, right?
Yeah, the best way to predict it was by your rulers to say, watch the other, watch the outsider. We've got to protect our borders. I think
then we've got to make our borders bigger, right?
Yeah.
And you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's Adam Smith, the economist, the one that Thatcher loves, who said capitalism is about perpetual growth.
Wow.
You know, and it's impossible. You just cannot have perpetual growth. That's why you got to keep making things to give to people. But you also need to keep telling people that we have these borders and we got to protect them from these foreign people. So you have to work harder and we've got to be bigger and we've got to be stronger. And so we have the kind of governments we have now. But the nation state is a very artificial thing. It's a human construct that actually has caused lots of deaths and separation.
Where has it not caused that? I was thinking about this before. Where has it not happened?
Even if it's not happened politically, and usually it has had impact politically, if you look at like Rwanda and places like that where it's separated tribes, literally alignment through tribes, you find places like Bangladesh, for example. Years ago, the people of Bangladesh would see the rains coming, they would go to higher ground into what is now India, and they would let the rains happen, and then they would come back down. Since the advent of the nation state and the border, they can't go to higher ground, because higher ground now is India. You've got to get a visa to miss the monsoons. So you can't do it. So, you know...
You've got to get a visa to miss the
monsoons. So even... that shows you that even a natural phenomenon... or let me put it the other way around. This idea of the border and nation states has caused people to die because of natural phenomena. Mm. But people would normally read the weather and move. You know, so migration is natural. Moving around is natural. Yeah. But I also want to say one other thing about the play that I haven't seen it yet.
No, neither have I.
Neither has he. And he's scared. But I do know that a lot of hard work's gone into it. And it's a lot of my novels, well, all my novels are supposed to be for young adults. And it's a play kind of for young adults. But the strange thing is that it's a kind of slight contradiction in my work. I write for young adults. A lot of the young adults will go, yeah, we know that. Yeah, it's real. It's real. So they know it. And there's a little part of me that's going, actually, I'm writing for adults. I want you to look into the world of the young adults. I want you to know what it's like to be a child refugee. I don't want to start talking about my other novel, but Face is about a boy that gets his face burnt off. And you know, I want adults to see what it's like to struggle when you've got a disability like that. Well, I don't think it's a disability, but the way that people treat him is like, is, you know. And then, you know, gangster rap is about gang culture. Now, one could say it's about young people, but also I want older people to look and understand the pressures that young people go through nowadays to belong to a gang. We all want to belong somewhere. So, you know, some people have to belong to a gang. Now, if you go to a gang that happens to be shooting, you start shooting. And Teacher's Dead is about, you know, a kid that murders a teacher. But, you know, there's more to it than that, you know. And so it's always, I always want... Although I'm supposed to be writing for young adults, there's a part of me that is really writing for adults to look into the world of young people and see how difficult it can be. I mean, if you think about... Sorry, I'm slightly going off subject now. But if you think about sex and sexual health and all that stuff, as Lem said, I'm an old man. I'm almost 100 now, right? No, I'm going to get a bit graphic now, but when I was a kid, there was hardly anything to worry about. You know what I mean? I mean, if you made a mistake, you know, you could get pregnant. And, you know, there was a simple way of dealing with that by using the contraception. Now, it can be a matter of life and death. I mean, that's serious. It's just so serious. I mean, when I was a teenager, the idea of it being like a real matter of life and death was... Now, if you're in a certain group of young kids and you've got the wrong clothes on, it could be a matter of life and death. Because these may not make you belong. You don't belong here because you're not keeping up with what we do. This is our style or whatever. Or if you've got the style and you're walking home and another group comes to you and they want your trainers or, you know, and all, obviously all the gadgets we have and stuff like that. I just think the pressure's on young kids now. I mean, what was the pressure on me when I was a kid? I just wanted pocket money. You know what I mean? It wasn't a matter of life or death like it is now. And
in your books, you're getting through to that, you're getting through to those kids in that mindset. What's really interesting is that a lot of kids who read Refugee Boy are coming now as adults to see the play because they relate to it just as much as adults, and this has given them an excuse to be able to relive a book that they loved as adults.
Because it's written
I've had that fed back to me.
How long ago was it? When was it published?
2001.
Right, and it was written probably 2 years before that. Mm. Right, because obviously.
So you got people who were 16 reading it, who are now 20, whatever, 27, 28, coming to see the play and revisiting the book.
I have a position at Brynhall University now, and
he's the freaking head of poetry, what's the title? What's the actual title?
I'm the chair of creative writing.
Chair of creative writing at Brunel freaking University.
All right, shut the fuck up.
I know, but
I'm professor of poetry and creative writing at Brunel University. And I meet these students and they come to me and they say, have you ever heard of Lim Si Hai?
And you're like, it doesn't ring a bell, but I'll ask a few people.
No, they come to me and they say, I mean, I look at them and... And they look at me, and sometimes they hardly even, if they don't know me, they kind of think I'm just a mature student. I tell them who I am and everything, and they go, oh, I read your book at school.
Yeah.
And some of them, my poetry, they'll go, I read it in primary school. I go, gosh, I'm old. You know, but look, I know that when I was a young teenager, I hated reading. I found it very difficult. And sometimes when they tell me what the stories are about, I go, what's that about? You know, no disrespect, but they used to tell me about Wuthering Heights and stuff like that. And I go, I'm a Birmingham kid and I'm in the middle of Birmingham. And, you know, I'm worried about the way I'm policed and I'm worried about the National Front and I'm just like, Wuthering Heights. So I say, when I start a book, what would the 13, 14-year-old me like to have read? I didn't really read books, you know. Storytelling was my thing. Listening to stories from Africa and Caribbean, and then just listening to poetry and music, reggae music, you know, stuff like that. I didn't come from a bookish family. My parents didn't really read books, just the Bible. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Len, was you reading in your adopted home?
Well, they were kind of crazy Christians. Yeah, I'm not against Christianity, but they were. So I could read Lion, Witch in the Wardrobe, Enid Blyton, because they were all Christians.
Right.
They were all really. Yeah, there was a lot of those books are about Christianity in a really sort of metaphorical way.
Right.
Did a lot of reading of the Bible.
Yeah.
Foster Dad was an English teacher as well, so T.S. Eliot's McCavity the Cat. You know, like, and that was it, really. But then I left them at 11, and then there was nothing because the children's homes, they didn't have books in them, you know. But I think that starts. I think reading the Bible actually, which is a cracking book, it's done all right, you know. I mean, whether you believe in it or not, you know, it's a big seller. It's got stories in it, you know, and that's really where my sort of stuff came from. I don't know whether I want to admit to that, but I've got to an age where I'm like, fuck, you know. That must have had some influence, even if I don't want to...
The Bible?
Even if I...
Oh, I mean, I've read the Bible, Quran and Torah, and other holy books, and they are great sources of stories and inspiration, and I think, personally, a lot of them are based on kind of folk laws that came before them, and they've kind of, you know, wrote a version for their times, just like we writers are writing things for our times.
Yes.
And the other thing is... Len probably wouldn't have experienced this so much because of his experience, but for us Caribbean people, the church You know, I'm in the black churches now. You know, the singing and the clapping and the tambourines and the preaching. My mother was a fiery preacher. And so when I see my poetry, I can see a lot of it came from her, you know. And then Lem got his from me.
Like poets, they look at each other, you know, and see each other. Like, I've seen Benjamin, like, you know, for years, and see him surfing, you know, and cutting a path, and it's lessons, you know. And I know he actually learned it all from me, but it's lessons of living. But it's actually all the writers cut their individual paths, the ones who are good, you know, and just keep on keeping on, you know, through the piece of paper, through the performance, onwards, onwards, onwards. It's a very actually lonesome but definite, not a lonely, but definite path. And you can look at the ones you respect and think, that's it, you know, that's pretty much it. What that person is doing is it. You can't copy another person. You can only be more of what you are as a writer, you know. Otherwise, I'd be writing novels for days, right? Because I've been trying and it's incredibly difficult. The most amazing thing about writing, I've had a book deal with Canongate for like 5 years to do my biography, you know, to write my story. The actual act of writing good sentences so that the person just understands them naturally may feel really simple. It's actually incredibly difficult. You can't copy that. You just can't, unless you're one of those really highly intelligent people who can just also, you know, write anything. But then if you can, you wouldn't just copy somebody. You would mine that thing that Benjamin mines and that I mine, you know, and cut your path. You know, it's rock stone, you know. You're making it's a wonderful thing, but I just wanted to be really clear about that circularity thing. You know, there's a lot of new poets try to get it, like, oh, Lem, how did you do it? You know, as if it's there's some magical experiment. And it's not, it's hard work.
Yeah, you have to kind of understand that you are you, and sometimes you can take inspiration from people.
Yeah.
But you have to cut your own path, as them said. It's a bit like, you know, I've heard this a lot. One musician says to another musician, you really inspire me. That musician listens to the other musician and goes, I can't hear me in there.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it means copying them. You know, so I mean, I've had people that, I'm a kind of ranting poet, really, right? And I've heard people say, I'm really inspired by your poetry, you know, it really got me thinking and writing. And then I look or listen to their work, and it's completely different to mine. I go, oh, that's great, you know, because I inspired them to find their voice.
Yes.
I didn't inspire them to copy me.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful thing to say, because I've got this aversion against the giving people a voice. I keep hearing this all the time. Mm. Oh, you know, it's our job to give the community a voice, or to give, you know. And I think to myself, that's not it. It's what you said. You find, you know, if you're inspired to find your own voice, that's the key difference between I've given a voice to people.
Sometimes I use the phrase giving a voice. I tell you, when I use that phrase, for example, I got all these kids who have been in trouble with the police, they're having trouble with their families, stuff like this, and I got them to write their poetry. Now, that's giving them a voice, but more importantly, I got their probation officers, police officers, that was the audience. Put them in the audience, and right now you listen to them. We love doing what we do. I don't see Lem often as I like to, so when we get together sometimes we have a good time. But at the same time, we have serious messages that we want to get out there. We want to change the world, but we know that we can't just have a revolution tomorrow and change things. So in our own artistic, creative way, we just want to try and prick people's minds and raise people's consciousness. We're not always right, but at least we try, and we try and have an opinion about stuff. And, you know, we just try and, what's the word?
Keep on keeping on.
Keep on keeping on, and trying to have kind of adventures of the mind, and share those adventures with other people.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
And keep it legal.
Of course, of course.